Well, let's turn to Romans and to chapter 11. And we're thinking about this general subject in chapters 9 through to 11 of the question of the Jews and Paul's concern for Jewish people. And there's one verse, verse 26, even though we're not going to actually, we may well not reach that verse in our exposition this week, but it's a challenging verse, verse 26 of Romans 11, and so all Israel shall be saved. And the question we want to consider tonight is, who are all Israel? How is it that all Israel can be saved? Especially when chapter 10, for example, began with the verse, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. I bear them record, they have a zeal of God, but not according to knowledge. They're ignorant of God's righteousness. So how do we get to, and so all Israel shall be saved? Well, we start thinking about that, and so all Israel shall be saved. And the words and so lead us to expect that Paul has already proved it and has shown us how all Israel can be saved, because now he's saying, and so all Israel shall be saved. Where does he say that? Where does he prove it? Well, this chapter certainly, verse 1, hath God cast away his people? And the answer, and so, as shown in this chapter, and the answer is God forbid. And then, and so, as shown in this chapter, all Israel shall be saved. But you know, Paul didn't divide his letter into chapters. That came much later in history, when the Bible was divided up into chapters. And this chapter is the third of three chapters which deal with the place of Israel in God's purposes. So just looking back to chapter 9, Paul began on a very personal note, which he repeats at the beginning of chapter 10 and again at the beginning of chapter 11, which maybe is why the dividers, those that divided it up into chapters, put the break just there. I think it's a good place to have it. But in chapter 9, verses 1 to 8, Paul insists that he had a great longing for Jewish people to be saved. He says he could almost, not quite, but almost wish himself accursed, cut off from Christ, if it meant the Jews would be saved. But not all Israelites were the true Israel. That's really the key to this whole thing. When God says he's going to save all Israel, who is he speaking about? Well, he's worked it out already, but he's going to work it out further in this chapter. But not all Israelites were the true Israel. Not all were those faithful, believing Israelites. So in verses 9 to 24 of chapter 9, Paul contended for God's absolute right to save whoever he wanted to. And there was the teaching about God's true people there. And he said that the Lord is like a potter with the clay in his hands. And the potter has got every right to do what he wants with the clay in his hands. So we have in that chapter the teaching that only Jacob's line of descendants, not Esau, but Jacob from the Old Testament, were the true Israel. And then the potter still had power over the clay. Verses 25 to 30, who were God's true people? And it would seem that they include believing Gentiles. And verses 31 to 33 of chapter 9 indicate that. So the big question to me is not how will all Jews be saved? Does it mean all Jews? It clearly doesn't mean all Jews. It's a question of whether all Israel is just believing Jews, or is it believing Jews and Gentiles together? And in both senses it's true. And the way that God speaks about the church of Jews and Gentiles, he speaks about them as being the fulfillment of God's promise that he would save Israel. And so it would seem to me, and that's my view, that they include believing Gentiles. And when it says all Israel, it's saying that all the true Israel of God, which is Jews and Gentiles, who have the faith that Abraham had. That's the key. Then in chapter 10, Paul again affirms his personal feelings for Jewish people and describes how it's not the righteousness which Jewish people sought to establish for themselves, but the righteousness which is of faith, provided by Christ and provided to us by faith. That's the righteousness which is of faith, not the righteousness which the Jews were going about, he says, trying to establish for themselves. It's all about believing. It's all about calling on Christ to save. And we saw last time that it requires a preacher. He's the man with the beautiful feet, in the sense that the people love to hear, when their hearts are tuned to the grace of God, to hear the message of the preacher. It's like he had beautiful feet. And hearing the gospel in order to have faith to be saved. And chapter 10 finished with Isaiah's assertion that in the massive wave of Gentile conversions which had already occurred and which were still occurring, God was found of them that sought him not. And now in chapter 11, Paul asks an important question. He says, hath God cast away his people? And he answers, God forbid. So God has not written off all Jewish people. There is still salvation for Jews. What we should try to understand is, how can all Israel be saved when thousands of years have elapsed and many Jews have rejected Christ? And we know that Christ is the only way of salvation. No matter what religion a person might be, or what branch of the Christian religion, it's only through Christ that a person can be saved. So we look at the first five verses of chapter 11, verses 1 to 5, God's faithfulness. The worry people might have, genuine Christian people, is all to do with God's faithfulness to his promises. If we are to understand the word of God aright, we can't believe that God can ever be unfaithful to his promises, because that's absolutely central to the scriptures, that God always keeps his promise. And he has promised salvation for Israel. And in verse 26, which we haven't reached but I've mentioned, Paul assures us, and so in this way, as proven by the above, all Israel shall be saved. So we want to see how we get to that. I've referred in previous weeks to the idea that some people have, and usually, strangely enough, nearly all the people who think this are not Jews. They're Gentiles, they're people like you and I, who've got hold through listening to the internet or reading strange books, that somehow all Israel, literally, will be saved. Somehow God is going to save the whole Jewish race. Now, I've not met anyone, I'm not saying there aren't some, but I've not met anyone who includes in that every Jew since Abraham. It'd be quite hard to fit the Pharisees who came and criticized Christ and the priests who had him crucified in all Israel shall be saved. But the usual idea is that in the future there'll be some new dispensation of God. Some divided up into dispensations. There was a man called Schofield, who produced the authorized version with more footnotes than the text of the Bible in the 19th century. And he brings in this idea that there's a whole new way God is dealing with people when he starts working on the Jews at some future age, and he's going to save all the Jews. There's going to be that new dispensation when God will bring in all Jews who are alive at the time of Christ's second coming, or something similar, just before that maybe, he's going to bring them all to believe, to trust. And I think even he would say that it has to be believing in Christ. Although many of the dispensationalists do go as far as to say God is going to so restore Israel that they'll bring back the temple and the sacrifices. Well, to me that's complete blasphemy, to think that God would reintroduce something which Christ has abolished, the sacrifices. The most disturbing view is that the people of Israel will recover their land. and that they'll go back to their land. God isn't interested in geography, in the land, and all the promises about the land are fulfilled in the spiritual land, in coming to Christ and having the new Canaan, the new Jerusalem. And you only have to read, and I haven't included this in my thoughts tonight really, but the epistle to the Ephesians. And if you read Ephesians, just look at that, the first two chapters, and say, well, what is God interested in? And it's the church. And the church is made up, and that's the whole argument of chapter 2 of Ephesians, Jew and Gentile, no difference, the wall has been brought down. Why is God going to put that wall back up again? Surely he's not. So the term cast away is very emphatic. When Paul says, has God cast away his people? It means rejected, pushed away. Has God pushed his people away? And it's a final casting away. It's God's wiping away of all Israel, all Jews, out of his eternal purposes in salvation. Now, if it was God forbid, God is going to bring every Jew who's alive at the time of Christ's second coming to believe, it would say so, but it doesn't say that. What it says is, hath God cast away his people? God forbid. And here's his first argument, for I also am an Israelite, of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. So he's saying, if God had cast away the Jews, I wouldn't be saved. If God wasn't dealing with Jewish people and was still prepared to save them, I wouldn't be saved. And he gives something of his pedigree. I'm an Israelite, I'm a real Israelite, of the seed of Abraham. I'm of the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin was that tribe which was included with Judah in that southern kingdom. No, God has not cast away his people. But you notice the argument, the answer is in an individual. He's not saying God is going to save a whole body of people or a whole generation of Jews. He says, it can't be true because God has saved me. So he's saying God is still saving individuals. And there were many individuals who were saved in the day that Paul ministered and preached. But here is Paul, and somehow, is God going to save the whole Jewish race? Well, no, surely not. But he needs to put Israel's place in God's purposes into context, because God is faithful to his promises. He has promised salvation to Israel. But in context, what we're looking for is an explanation of how all Israel will be saved. And in verse 1, has God cast away or thrust away or totally written off Israel? And the answer is no. Look, he saved me. The Jews didn't suddenly cease to be his people. They were his people from of old. In a sense, they're still his people. He cannot have written them off completely. God forbid. It's unthinkable. But even here in verse 1, we find that God's promise to save his people doesn't mean Israel en bloc. Every man, woman, and child, because his first answer is me, myself. But then he uses this second expression. He says, God has not cast away his people, which he foreknew. Well, which of his people did he foreknow? Well, we know that he didn't foreknow all the Jews. Remember, we dealt with this when we were looking through the 5 points of Tulip some weeks ago. And we talked about the total depravity of man, that's Jew and Gentile, totally lost before God, unconditional election, limited atonement, and then the irresistible calling of God and the final perseverance of the saints. And we looked at Romans chapter 8. This is where this is so familiar to us. We saw it in Romans 8, verses 28 to 30. There are men and women who God has called by his effectual, irresistible calling. Remember when God called you when we were in Sunday school and all you were thinking about was getting outside and playing snowballs, if it was that time of year, or what you were thinking about doing. When you're older, perhaps you're thinking about going home and having your dinner. Whatever it is, God called and you didn't answer, but then God called in such a way that you could not resist. And in Romans 8, we've been through all this before, but I'm just reminding you, there are men and women who God has called in this effectual, irresistible way. And that's every blood-bought child of God. Every Christian who's been converted has been called by the grace of God. But first of all, he foreknew them. We're told that those he foreknew, them he also called. And them he called, them he also justified. That's all Jews and Gentiles. From them he called, he justified, and he also glorified. He took on the task of bringing us to heaven. So Paul in verse 2 is saying, God has not cast away or finally written off the Jews, those Jews who were foreknown, those who were predestinated, called, justified, and glorified. He's not saying God has not cast away any Jews. There is a sense in which God has cast away the nation because they rejected Christ. But then individuals are the true Israel, and he has called them, he has foreknown them. And then he goes on to give us another clue, because he says, he gives the doctrine of the remnant. He says, God has not cast away his people which he foreknew. Watch ye not, which is, do you not know, what the scripture says about Elijah? Well, you do know that, but you don't know it very well yet, because it's next Sunday that we're dealing with Elijah, the Sunday after, with this particular part. It's when Elijah was very depressed. He went through a period when he was full of courage, and he went before King Ahab and he told Ahab, let my people go. Well, that was Moses, but he said the same thing. He said, because you've sinned, because of the great sin of making these golden calves and allowing Baal to be the god and the religion of Israel, it's not going to rain for 3.5 years. And it didn't rain for 3.5 years. And when Elijah came back and it did rain, many of the prophets, all the prophets, were killed. And Jezebel, the queen, she was ranting and raving and saying, I'm going to kill Elijah. And Elijah was panic-stricken. But it was more than just being afraid. He was downcast, because he said, surely all Israel should be turning to the Lord now. Why are they not? They've seen fire from heaven. And instead, they were all slinking back to their homes. And, well, I suppose we're a Baal-worshipping nation. That's what we've got to do, even though Baal was proved to be false. So Jezebel threatened, and Elijah ran. And he ran away, and he interceded. We read here that he made intercession against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed thy prophets and digged down thine altars, and I'm left alone, and they seek my life. But what did God say? Verse 4, I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Even so then, at this present time, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. So the answer to hath God cast away his people completely is no, there is a remnant. There are those who are still being saved amongst the Jewish nation. And remember that Paul wrote this, it was fairly early in his ministry, but he had already been to various places. He'd been to Antioch in Pisidia, and to Derbe, Lystra, and Iconium. And then he started his second missionary journey, and he went to those places again, and he preached, and the Jews were saved. Many Jews were saved. Many rejected, and once they rejected, God rejected them. And Paul turned away and went to the Gentiles. But hundreds of Jews were saved, and they were the remnant. And he says here, I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. That's in Elijah's day. Even so then, at this present time, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. God was still saving Jews, but they were a remnant. And he says, it's by grace. Grace isn't works. That's what he says in verse 6. Works is works, grace is grace. So he says in verse 7, what then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for. And he personifies it. Israel was the other name for Jacob. So Jacob and his descendants had not obtained, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded. And there he's talking about the legal blinding of those that finally reject Christ. According as it is written, God has given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see and ears they should not hear. So we read, Paul has demonstrated that far from casting away his people, the Jews, God has reserved a good number. There was Paul himself, and then the remnant being those that in his day, and then forever afterwards, in every generation, there are Jews who are saved. There are people in Israel today who are Christians. God has told us here, Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for. That's in general. Now Paul is speaking about the Jews who rejected Christ. First of all, we read they were seeking for salvation. They made every effort. You couldn't fault them, and you still can't. You've got to admire Jewish people. Look what they've been through. Think of the last war and the World War, all that the Jews went through then, and all for the good cause of being faithful Jews. Until the events we have seen today, which are causing great doubts as to the validity of Israel, but on our TV screens and newspapers, we see things now which make us think less of the Jewish nation because of the murder which is going on with the bombing of hospitals and children's schools and things like that. But we would still have a great respect for the Jews. You only have to drive through parts of London on a Saturday, thinking of Clapton and Stamford Hill, to see Jewish families making their way to and from the synagogue in their Jewish garb, with their heads and the beards and the black. They were exposing themselves to complete ridicule. And you've got to admire them. You've got to say, well, they have courage. They won't allow a cynical, sneering generation to make them embarrassed at their clothing or general deportment or what they believe. But Paul is still in his sad mode. He's saying, but they haven't obtained. For all they go through, they haven't obtained what they're looking to obtain. They're unsaved. They're lost. They're condemned. But the election, that's Jews and Gentiles, that God has declared his love for and revealed himself to, they have obtained it. So don't think in terms of Gentiles and Jews. Think in terms of those that have believed and those that haven't believed. Many Gentiles don't believe. Many Jews don't believe. Many Gentiles do believe. Many Jews do believe. So true believers who have welcomed Christ into their hearts, when Christ came, hundreds did receive him. Most of the population didn't. The leaders significantly rejected Christ, and they wrote their own awful destiny. It was just the elect, just those that God persisted with and brought to himself, and many, many Jews, hundreds of Jews, 3,000 on the day of Pentecost. They were all Jews. Even though they were from different parts of the world, they were all Jewish. The rest were blind to him, and they were blinded. And we might leave this until next week to deal with more thoroughly, but there is such a thing as the judicial blinding of Israel. And it's something I need to go into in more detail with you. But if you look at verses 7 to 10, what then? Israel has not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded. In what sense? Well, it says in verse 8, according as it is written, God hath given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear, unto this day. And we think, well, it doesn't sound fair, does it? If God is blinding people, how can they possibly believe? Oh, but they've already disbelieved. They've already written their own doom. They rejected that generation, Christ, when they'd seen him raise people from the dead and heal the blind and heal lepers, and hundreds of people were cured and people's lives were wonderfully changed. And why didn't they believe? Well, because they were prejudiced. They would not believe because it was against everything that they wanted to believe. And eventually God gave them the spirit of slumber. He gave them eyes that they should not see. And we should not look at that and say, well, you know, that's the Jews, because it can happen to any of us. It can be for all of us who, if we reject Christ and keep on rejecting him, ultimately, God is not going to go on hammering at the door for us to come to him till the day that we die. We wouldn't expect him to, but he'll give us many opportunities, and then when all our opportunities are used up, why, God might give us the spirit of slumber, eyes that we should not see, ears that we should not hear. And David, and this is in Psalm 69, he said, "Let their table be made a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened that they may not see, and bow down their back always." And it's the teaching, which is quite a hard one, but it's nevertheless there. And it doesn't do anything against the faithfulness of God. It doesn't say anything that God is not faithful to his promise. But the judicial blinding of Israel, where they so rejected that he blinded their eyes that they would not see. It's not just Israel, as I say. It can happen to all of us. But they rejected Christ. So for all who were not elect, their eyes were blinded to the truth. But then he goes on and he says, in verse 11, "I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall?" That is, finally fall, and all Jews be lost. God forbid. "But rather through their fall, salvation is come unto the Gentiles." And that's how it happened. When you look at the book of Acts and those early chapters, from chapter 13 onwards, when Paul came with the message to a different place, and he preached in the synagogue, and the Jews listened, and some of them were saved. But then, by and large, they said no, and they turned against Paul, and they started to ridicule him and preach other things and refuse the gospel. He turned to the Gentiles, and the Gentiles happily received the gospel. Well, that's what he's saying here. Have they stumbled that they should fall? Is that the ultimate purpose? No, God forbid, but through their fall, salvation is come to the Gentiles, to provoke them to jealousy. And they were jealous. And the reason why they took Paul out of the city and stoned him and tried to kill him at Lystra was because they were jealous. They could see what he was saying and that the Gentiles were being converted, and they were jealous. It was not so much jealousy because they wanted it, it was envy. Envy that the message was getting to these people and that they were listening to a great teacher of the Jews. He says, "I speak to you Gentiles," because most of the people he wrote to in Rome would have been Gentiles, "because I am an apostle of the Gentiles. I magnify mine office." And what he says is, "If the fall of them," in verse 12, "be the riches of the world," that is, of those who are converted out of the world, "and the diminishing of them the riches of the Gentiles, how much more their fullness?" They're not written off as one here is saved, another there, and then three over there. Jews are converted. That is the fullness. And he says, "If by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are my flesh, and might save some of them." There is still the possibility that the Jews who saw that the Gentiles were being converted could turn. And they did, and there were those that turned. And he says, "If the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead?" And so there are those that say, ah, yes, eventually there'll be a great receiving of Christ, and the Jews will all be saved. But that's not what he's saying, because he's proved through this chapter that what he's saying is that Paul himself was an individual who was converted. There were those who were foreknown of God. They were the elect. They're saved. And those that of the same people who heard the gospel and did believe in his day when he went to Iconium and Lystra and Derbe and all those cities, well, they are the proof. They are the fullness. They're the ones that are received. They're life from the dead. And that's what he's saying. The whole point is not that there's going to be a major turning of the Jews to Christ. There may be. It would be a wonderful thing. Sometimes God answers his promise in more than one way. And he'll say, well, I told you I was going to do it, and I've done it in this way. And maybe many Jews will be saved towards the end. But I don't think we get it clearly taught in the scriptures that that's going to happen. What we're told is that God will still save Jews and Gentiles until the time that Jesus returns from heaven. Well, we'll go on to talk next week about the analogy here about the first fruits, the lump and the root and the branches of the olive tree and the grafting in. And we'll talk about that next week. And this wonderful last little bit, almost a poem at the end, "Oh, the depths of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God." So we'll leave those verses till next time. Well, let's turn to